love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
We came up with this idea that I would carry the torch in the Olympics, and I would not only Hell's Angel would sponsor this, I would myself as a member would carry the torch. So we paid the fee, and of course, they had no idea who Hamcus was. What I put was HAMCUS, Hell's Angels Motorcycle Club, United States. So we had this reporter kind of working with us, Clara Spiegel from the LA Times. So she goes down to the torch relay board and she said, "Are you going to allow Hamcus to participate?" And they said, "Well, why wouldn't we?" And she said, "Well, do you know who Hamcus is?" And they said, "No, who is it?" She goes, "It's the Hell's Angels." And they adjourned the meeting, made everybody leave. About 20 minutes went by and they came back and they said, "Anybody that follows the regulation and participate and pays the $3,000 fee can enter." So they accepted us, and I wound up carrying that torch.
Well, hey, everybody. Welcome back to part two of our interview on Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. Our guest this week is George Christie, former 40-year member of the Hell's Angels Motorcycle Club. Some of us call that OMG, the Outlaw Motorcycle Gangs. George doesn't like that too much, so Outlaw Motorcycle Club.
Well, I have to say club, otherwise everybody would be sending me hate mail. I need the guys from my side that see this.
Oh, you know what? The fact that you're talking to a 38-year veteran cop, yeah, they're probably going to get some hate mail anyway.
That's all right. I can take the heat.
Yeah, and I tell you what, yesterday's interview was very interesting. And my whole goal here is just to find out about your life, what you did, what it's like to be inside of a club like that, what your thoughts were when certain things went on. I mean, within 5 years, you're president of a chapter of the Hell's Angels in California, the chapter that you actually opened yourself, right, in Ventura?
Correct. Yeah, we were in Los Angeles, and like I said, there had been six murders within 6 months, and we couldn't go anywhere. Cops were everywhere. Surveillance was incredible. I started getting paranoid. I was thinking everything was bugged, and I came up with this idea. You're laughing when I said bug.
Yeah, I understand.
And I told people, I think we got to get out of here. And I said, "You guys aren't going to want to hear this, but I think we ought to move up to Ventura." And I said, "Tactical retreat is what this is. And the Satan slaves have been talking about becoming Hell's Angels. If the Satan slaves became Hell's Angels and we moved up to Ventura, all kind of within the same time frame, the investigation is going to switch to all the people that weren't involved in anything that was transpiring between us and the Mongols, because they weren't in the Hell's Angels at that particular point in time." So the club agreed on it. Satan slaves agreed. We packed up, moved to Ventura, and the investigation, as I predicted, shifted onto the new Hell's Angels in San Fernando Valley, which was the Satan slaves, and they were just chasing a ghost. They weren't involved in any of that stuff. And it took them several years because the police didn't share anything.
Mm-hmm.
It took them probably 4 or 5 years to figure out that we had gone up to Ventura.
Sad thing about that with the cops not sharing, is that still a problem today?
Well, that's not surprising me at all. You know,
I've worked in the DA Special Operations Division for 5 years, where it's a multi-agency facility, and I mean, it's almost coming to fisticuffs almost on a weekly basis between agencies, because everybody wants to be protective of their information. In my last 3 years, I was the director of a fusion center. I think we had 18, 21 agencies, something like that. And it was like herding cats. Everybody's got their own little thing, and this agency wants to do that because they're bigger or they're whatever.
Yeah, I was instrumental in stopping the war in Sweden, in Denmark, Finland, and all those Scandinavian countries. They call it the great Nordic bike war. And imagine on a plane and going to Europe and telling those guys you don't like what they're doing. And you got these big, giant Viking-looking guys. I'm over there telling them, hey, man, this isn't flying. And I'm glad they had some smart leaders, guys like Blondie and Janka and whatnot, understood what I was trying to do. I was trying to keep the war with the Bandidos from bleeding into the United States. Because we'd had an up and down relationship with them. We were at war with the outlaws. We were fighting the Mongols. And then we were going to wind up probably getting it on with the Bandidos here in the United States. And trying to prevent that.
I read in your book that when you arrived over there, they treated you like royalty.
Yes.
They just wined you and dined you, took real good care of you.
Yeah, they always did. Yeah, and it's funny because when I got there, the immigration people were all there and I have to show my passport. And the immigration officers, they had some sort of thing going with the Danish Hells Angels. And they looked at all the Danish Hells Angels. There must have been 20 of them waiting there for me. They go, look, a real Hells Angel from California. Started yelling at each other, their native language. I don't know what the hell they were saying, but it was kind of funny, you know.
Yeah, I've had a sense of humor.
They did have a sense of humor, and I told them as I was leaving, like, thanks a lot. But interesting, you know, and I don't know if you've ever been to Amsterdam.
I have.
So you know what it's like over there. Yeah, I haven't been there from many years. The last time I was there, Hell's Angels, Big William was the boss. I don't know if you ever heard of him. Had a lot of political clout. You know, he had, the country had given him the clubhouse there. And, you know, they did all the security for the red light district for the government. It was quite an interesting experience for me. Got guys like Big Will and Janka. He's not in the club anymore, but he was a very prominent member in Denmark when that war was going on over there. And he became a target.
Yeah. And I had it further down the list here, but you became known as a peacemaker within the motorcycle clubs, where it sounds like you're trying to get the clubs to get along rather than fighting each other, which is...
Yeah. And it wasn't like, oh, I'm going to set out to be a peacemaker, because I'll tell you, being a peacemaker in an outlaw bike club's not a popular position.
I'll bet.
I had a lot of people raising their eyebrows at me and wanted to know what my hidden agenda was. And, you know, I had no hidden agenda. I just got tired of getting shot at, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my desire was to get on my motorcycle and be able to ride across country and not worry about what town I was in. Because, you know, we'd go across country. We used to ride with San Bernardino a lot. We were real close to two charters. We'd go across country with 30 guys every year to all meet up for the United States run. It was an annual Hell's Angel run. And, I mean, we'd get out in the states where there were clubs we were fighting with. We'd have to have a guard out all night long, make sure they didn't wire any of the cars up or bikes with explosives or anything. You know, it was something I really wanted to stop. But I was successful, and it, you know, ultimately it all unraveled. You know, it always does, yeah. It seems like.
What is you mentioned a run. So what is the purpose of these cross-country runs or Sturgis or the different places you go, Laughlin?
Well, the idea is, you know, you get together, you're an organization, you're a club, you're biking, it's a brotherhood. You know, a lot of people in law enforcement, you know, think that's a cover for your narcotics transactions and whatnot. And for some people, it has been over the years. But the club is not a criminal organization. But I will concede it's an organization with criminals in it. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd be lying. The record speaks for itself. But you go on these runs and you get to see people you haven't seen in a year. You get to exchange motorcycle thoughts, ideas, a lot of club politics going on there. You know, it depends what crew you run with. You know, and I don't know how it is in law enforcement, but you go to these runs and you've got Hells Angels that are really into custom motorcycles. Then you've got Hells Angels that are really into the politics of the Hells Angels. So you got all these different little factions talking about what's going on. Then, you know, you've got your strict party guys. They want to drink beer and chase girls. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of things transpire at these runs. In Ventura, we were very strict about it. We'd make people go to the runs, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're a member, you're a member. That's
exactly.
In your book. If you're in, you're all the way in.
Yeah, you got to be in 100%. If you're not in, you're going to get talked about when all the guys get together. Where in the hell is so-and-so? Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether it's true or not, somebody may make some cavalier statement. Oh, his new girlfriend's, you know, she's a bitch. And then mm-hmm. next thing you know, you've got this little group of guys that are looking down their nose at him for whatever reason, whether real or imagined. You know?
Right, yeah. Right. Sounds like law enforcement.
Yeah, I get that feeling.
Given all the responsibilities that go with this and the requirements to be available and, you know, you have to go on a run, you have to do this, you have to do that, how in the world do you have a family?
You don't, in a sense. I mean, I destroyed two marriages. I was married for 20-some years. You wind up being like, if you get immersed in the club like I did, you wind up, like, I'm writing a new book and I make a reference in this book I'm working on. I was like a young CEO in a big corporation. I devoted all my time and energy to the people around me, not to the people that maybe were more important for me as I reflect back now. So after 25 years, get a divorce. I'm single for 10 years. I meet another gal and wind up, you know, getting married and, you know, having a couple of kids with her. That marriage unraveled when I went to prison and 2014, when I came home in 2014, I kind of knew it was over. But, you know, it's hard to keep a relationship together. I think law enforcement experiences the same thing.
It is. It takes a very special spouse to put up with. Yeah. I mean, I would like to criticize you about you gave up your family for the motorcycle club, but you know what? I gave up my family for, this is my second marriage. And I mean, fortunately, we've been married 40 years now, so I think it's going to last.
Yeah.
She was with me in Colombia. She was with us when we adopted our daughters. Still with me, putting up with all the crap that I do. But there was, especially when we were in Colombia, I was never home. I was living in Medellin. We were chasing Pablo Escobar. And it's can't criticize somebody when you did the same damn thing they did, right?
Well, I'm telling you. Fair. You know, I used to get criticized for this, but I had a lot of people in law enforcement that I considered friends. I still do. You know, Jamie McBride. I consider him a friend. Saw him over the holidays. Probably see him again before summer comes. But, you know, what makes somebody choose a particular lifestyle? I got a letter from the, it's a funny story. When I came home from the Marines, I got a letter from the LAPD. They trying to recruit me. And it's funny. My dad said, that's a dangerous damn job, you know. You want to be a cop? And I wound up the leader of the Hells Angels. He used to laugh about that for years. He thought that was the funniest damn thing. He goes, I should have let you been a cop. It was funny.
That would have been an interesting story, wouldn't it? I mean, you could have been a motorcycle cop.
Yeah, I could have been.
Now, one thing I want to cover is I think some girl came and told somebody in the club about some guy that was showing off a fake Hells Angels patch.
Correct.
You guys got a little upset about that, didn't you?
We got real upset about that. You know, we take that stuff real seriously. And, you know, it's funny nowadays, you know, they talk about, we're going to turn this over to the lawyers. Back in the 70s, we'd go for those out-of-court settlements. Yeah. You know, we got word about this guy, and he was selling a bunch of coke down in L.A. It took us a while. We got his address and, you know, found out where he was. And I actually broke in his car and waited for him. I was on the floorboard in the back seat, had a blanket over me, and I waited for him to get in the car. Unbeknownst to me, he had somebody with him. I thought he was in the bar by himself. This guy came back out with him, and I popped up over the back seat, stuck a gun in the back of his ear, and just said, I want that patch. And of course, I don't know what you're talking about. And we rode out to the desert. And it's funnier than hell. We got stopped on the way out there, and that cop must have smelled a rat or something, man. You know, something wasn't right. And we told the guys, because we had them both handcuffed. We had them, the guy in the front was handcuffed, and the guy in the back was handcuffed. We had blankets over us like we were cold, like the heater wasn't working. And I just think it was police intuition. I think the cop came there. He just looked at it and goes, this ain't right. And he's thinking, there's four guys here. I'm getting the hell out of Dodge. And he just checked the license and registration and went and got in his car and left. We continued out to the desert. And the guy in the back seat, he told the guys, if you start screaming, he goes, I'm going to shoot the cop and then I'm going to shoot both of you guys. And we're going to torch the car and just leave you guys here. And I guess we'll just have to forget about that patch. But, you know, he got out to the desert and had him dig his grave. At the end of the day, the sun was going down. It was just too much for him. I said, why don't you come here with me and we'll watch this last sunset together? And he broke down. I could see he was getting ready to break down. He said, what if I did have a patch? I said, well, we go back to town and we get it. And we went back to town. He admitted everything. So we went back to town. One of the guys was so damn mad at him, he shot him with a taser when we got in the house. He just had to shoot him with something. I figured better a taser than a pistol.
But a taser's funny. Pistol,
yeah,
not so.
No, he was flopping around on the floor like a fish. But what happened was I reached into the closet. I said, where's it at? He goes, it's in there. So I had him step against the wall. And I reached in and I pulled it out. And you can see it on the hanger. And the Hell's Angels, he was from the Bay Area. He got so mad, he just shot him with the taser. And the guy was flopping all around the floor. And, I mean, some people would say we robbed him. We considered it a tax, a street tax. You know, we took, he had a couple of pounds of cocaine in there and $30,000-$40,000. Or $20,000 in jewelry. We took all his stuff, and another team came back the next day. They heard what happened, and that I think they went there and took all his bikes. But I don't want to get involved in all that. I said, we came for the patch. We got the patch. We taxed the guy. Let's just get the hell out of here.
And, yeah. Yeah, what you call a tax is called a robbery.
Well,
sorry,
my daughter, my lawyer, she's probably, she sees us, she's probably pulling her hair out. I think the statute of limitations went out long ago. That was 1978 or something.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm safe, right?
Yep, yeah, absolutely. That's our laws. We go by the law.
And we do go by the law.
Now, I do want to ask you about, there was an individual, I think in another biker gang, that disrespected somebody and he fled and you guys couldn't find him, but you finally found out he was in Arizona.
Oh, Big Jim Nolan's.
I think so.
Yeah, he was a leader of outlaws. He was responsible for the first murder in the war between the Hells Angels and the outlaws. It's interesting. I had been telling the story for years, and I recently started talking to a former outlaw boss, and he tells me a different story how it started. But nevertheless, a couple of Hells Angels went down to Florida to cover this ex-Hells Angels tattoo down there. And they got down there, and then the outlaws heard they were in town, invited them to the outlaw clubhouse, and ambushed them. Killed all three of them. Killed the two members and the ex-member, and threw them in a rock quarry. And one of the bodies floated up a couple days later, and that was Jim Nolan. And he just recently finished his term in prison. I think he shed 35, 40 years. I don't know, he did a long time.
Wow.
But I went to pay Jim a visit. Went out there to kind of end his tenure in the outlaws. I got up on the roof and I was waiting for him. And I kind of had this revelation that these people are no different than us. And really, what was he going to accomplish? And, you know, I packed up, took off, and he got arrested shortly after that. And the interesting thing is I ran into him in the Terre Haute bike show. I don't know if you remember that part of the book.
I didn't put the name together.
Okay, yeah, Big Jim Nolan. But is that what you're talking about when I went out there to?
Yeah.
I was going to take care of business, and I changed my mind. I had this epiphany. Is that how you say it?
Epiphany, yeah.
Yeah, my wife always scolds me when I don't say it right. But
I wish I hadn't corrected you now, because now I feel like your wife.
Was I set you up on that one, man? Well, you got to watch the one percenters, man. I still got that one percenters humor in me.
Yeah.
But came back, got deeper and deeper into the politics of the Hells Angels. The book you read kind of gives you an idea about my home life and everything. This new book I'm writing, strictly stripped down, it's just like you're hanging with me. It's every day what happens. And no love stories involved, no romance involved. It's just strictly business because, I mean, that's what I did for a lot of those years. That's why, you know, I broke up two marriages, you know.
Well, you made mention earlier about carrying a torch. So tell us about that, because that was shocking, to be honest with you.
Yeah, well, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms was going to do the security for the 1984 Olympics. They were going to do all the water sports, but they were going to do them up in Ohio at Lake Casitas, and the clubhouse was about 10 minutes from there. So when they came to town, they started talking to the local merchants and stirring a pot up and just saying, if you hear of any weapon sales, keep an eye on those Hells Angels. We heard they're going to supply weapons to terrorists up here at the water events. And these guys came from Akron, Ohio. They didn't know anything about the politics or the dynamics of Ventura. I was really integrated into the community, and they went to the wrong people. People started calling me merchants and whatnot, and they go, feds were down here, and they said, you're going to disrupt the Olympics. So I start thinking, man, we got to get out in front of this. I had been on the trademark board when we were really trying to control our trademark with a big company, Limbach and Sutton. And you know, they taught me you have to control the narrative if you want to protect your trademark. If you're starting to get bad press, you've got to redirect it to make it turn it into positive press. So when these guys started saying negative things, I thought, well, you know what? Not only will we support the Olympics, but we will participate in the Olympics by carrying the torch in the torch relay. And that was my statement back to the ATF, and they were not happy.
You know. I tell you what, I wouldn't have been happy either if I'd been about back then, but that's marketing genius right there.
Well, you got to get in front of the narrative. That's what Mr. Sutton taught me.
Tell everybody how that happened and what you had to pay and what you did.
Yeah, so I went to the club, and I said, hey, look, these guys are saying we're going to disrupt the Olympics. I go, what are we going to do? We got to get out in front of this. And a lot of people said, who cares? And we're Hell's Angels. What do we care about that? And I said, look, man, this terrorist activity, this is something that's going to be huge in the future, terrorism. I go, we don't want to get painted with that brush. So I finally talked to some of the key players into it. And I thought of different things. And there was a guy in San Fernando Valley named Tiny, who happened to weigh about 400 pounds. They always do. He was 6'6", weighed about 400 pounds. We came up with this idea that I would carry the torch in the Olympics. And I would not only, Hell's Angel would sponsor this, I would myself as a member would carry the torch. So we paid the fee. And of course, they had no idea who HACUS was. What I put was HACUS, Hell's Angels Motorcycle Club, United States. And I abbreviated it as HACUS. And so we had this reporter kind of working with us, Clara Spiegel from the LA Times. So she goes down to the torch relay board and she said, are you going to allow HACUS to participate? And they said, well, why wouldn't we? And she said, well, do you know who HACUS is? And they said, no. Who is it? And she goes, it's the Hell's Angels. And they adjourned the meeting, made everybody leave. She was there. And about 20 minutes went by, and they came back, and they said, anybody that follows the regulations participate and pays the $3,000 fee can enter. So they accepted this. She did a big press release in the LA Times, and the story just took off like wildfire. It was like a dog bites a man bites dog. It just caught everybody by surprise, and we did. I mean, we were in the newspapers every single day until the actual Olympic torch relay came. It was just incredible. And Sonny was recovering from throat cancer, and he had had his larynx cut out. And I had been doing, along with another guy, a guy named Irish O'Farrell, I'd been doing TV stuff, marketing, radio interviews, anytime anything came up. And he thought he was going to die. Figured he'd only be around a couple of years. And they didn't give him much hope. But he lasted until a couple of years ago. He was like 83 when he died. You know.
And for our listeners, we're talking about Sonny Barger.
He was a founder of the, along with a couple other guys, of the Oakland Hells Angels. Started in San Bernardino, then went to San Francisco, then went to Oakland, and just spread from there. Sonny was a very powerful voice in the club. He became the face and the voice of the Hells Angels until his cancer, and he kind of turned it over to me and this guy, Irish. And Irish got murdered, and I wound up kind of carrying that torch, no pun intended. But so it just was an incredible deal. They kept pushing us further and further. Initially, I was supposed to run down Main Street in Ventura, and then they realized it was going to get so big, they sent us out to Las Poses Road. And I mean, you couldn't even get in out there. I'll tell you, Murphy, it was packed.
Yeah,
it was just packed. Helicopters flying around, everybody taking pictures and whatnot. It was a madhouse.
Well, were you worried about one of the rival gangs taking you out while you're doing this?
Well, you know who they were worried about is the John Birch Society.
Really?
The John Birch Society. There's a couple of pictures of me floating around, and one of them, I've got a gal and another guy running next to me. They're both FBI agents, and they had to be my security because the John Birch Society said, you let this commie, panko, outlaw bike guy carry the torch? We're going to kill him. And I guess it was an actual threat, somebody in law enforcement that I was friends with. That's also the year the Russians didn't come. There was mentions of me carrying the torch in some of the discussions. I don't know if that's true or if that's just the guys in law enforcement pulling my chain.
Well, I mean, I like the way you describe how you were selected in the book to carry the torch. Can you tell us how you were selected out of everybody at DHA's?
Well, I was the only guy in shape. Everybody was drinking and partying, and I had a real strict regimen of working out every day and running. I was a runner at the time, so everybody said it was my big idea, so they just all kind of turned to me in the meeting. I got the dubious position of
being the thumbs up.
Yeah, I was the front man.
And, well, plus, you were involved in martial arts back then, too,
I was.
Right?
I was a martial arts teacher for many years. Used to teach my guys, and then I stopped teaching the public, and I was just teaching a handful of guys, and I got real deep into it. I was training with a lot of the One Hop Kwando guys, with Al DeCascos, and then I started with Eric Lee, Al DeCascos, and then I started training with Dan Inosanto and Larry Hartzell, the JKD guys, and they were incorporating a lot of Filipino fighting stick and dagger stuff. So I really got deep into it. It was great, you know. Great to keep me focused.
Really. Yeah. And that keeps you in shape.
It does keep you in shape.
Do you love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you got to check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
But back to the torch thing. Now, so there was a $3,000 donation, and that was right to go to help a nonprofit, right?
That's right. It was supposed to go to the Special Olympics. And I got into it with President Kennedy's sister, Eunice Shriver. Eunice basically told me, we started fighting about where the money was going to go. I think I did some press releases. Well, anyways, the phone rang one day, and it was Sergeant Shriver, Eunice Shriver's husband. You know who Sergeant Shriver was? Remember him? Yeah. I think he was
an ambassador, wasn't he?
Peace Corps ambassador, and then he was ambassador to France. I can't remember, but he's married to President Kennedy's sister. And so he gives me the old pep talk and said, would you like to speak to President's sister? You know, and I go, sure. And so I get on the phone with her and she starts arguing with me. She basically says, look, we're the Kennedys and we're not sending that money to Pottstown, Pennsylvania. We're keeping it here in Washington, and there's nothing you can do about it. And I said, well, I'm going to have to sue you. And so she starts speaking law to me, and she said, well, you're going to have to come to Washington then if you want to sue us. And I said, no, you're going to have to come to Ventura. The contract was signed in Ventura. And I said, that's where the lawsuit will take place. And I did my homework on it. I'm a frustrated lawyer. You know, I always wanted to be a lawyer. So she started arguing with me, and the last thing she said to me was, she said, you don't know who you're messing with, do you? I said, I don't think you know who you're messing with. We both hung up at the same time. And I took her to court. It took me like 6 years. I finally got the money. The kids in Pottstown wound up getting $6,000 because they didn't pay the money. I passed the hat again and got another $3,000 and sent it to Pottstown so they could get the equipment they wanted. They promised the kids, the special needs kids, that they were going to get all this equipment. And the money never went.
Yeah, some people think just because they're wealthy or they've got somebody in politics, they're more important than everybody.
They do, and I found it refreshing. The judge told the lawyers, she went out in the hall and talked to Mr. Christie, and the lawyers asked me, they go, what do you want? And I go, I want you to give the money to Pottstown, Pennsylvania. That's what I want. That's what I wanted all along. And they just kind of looked at me and looked at each other, and they said, okay, well, But they made me sign a non-disclosure agreement. I guess I'm breaching it right now. And you're right in the middle of it.
Well, maybe they'll show pity on two old guys. I don't know.
Yeah, I hope so, you know. My last term in prison was in 2011. I got indicted. And then I left in 2013. I went to Latuna, Texas. You ever been out in that area?
But I know where you're talking about.
Outside of El Paso. And I was hot and miserable. My sentencing was funny because Judge Wu was scolding the U.S. attorney. And the U.S. attorney wants this to be his trademark case.
Yeah.
Man. Yeah.
His legacy.
He got George Christie. And so Judge Wu was just giving him kind of a tongue lashing. He said, I know you want this case to be something, but it isn't what you think it is. No matter what you do, you can't turn it into what you want it to be. And so I'm sitting over there at the defense table all smug. And I swear to God, he doesn't miss a beat. He gets done pointing his finger at the U.S. attorney and he shifts over to me and he goes, and you, Mr. Christie. God only knows what you've gotten away with the last 40 years. And so he basically said, you guys got to negotiate this thing. And so we went down to Judge Walter's court, and the lawyers hashed it out. And we came back. It was funny. We walked back in the courtroom after a couple hours, and he goes, we must have an agreement. They both look mad.
He knows courtroom.
Yeah, he was the best judge I've ever been in front of.
So you mentioned ATF and FBI investigating. Did DEA ever come after you?
Well, yeah, the DEA did once. They had a big cocaine case down in San Diego. Their informant was trying to, he was going to give me 100 pounds of cocaine on the arm, you know, Freddie. And I just said, hey, look, man, somebody's giving you 100 pounds of cocaine. I go, I don't want nothing to do with it. I go, who are you, man? This guy was just some local small-time drug dealer in Ventura that wanted to be a Hell's Angel at one time. And I had personally run him off. So he had a little animosity towards me. But they used my connection with the Mexican Mafia. I was friends with the old-school, high-echelon Mexican Mafia guys. Mike Eisen, they called him Hacha, the Hatchet. Mm-hmm. And Joe Morgan was the boss at the time. I mean, they're all dead and gone, these guys. Like, most of the people in the club that I was close with, they're all gone. You know, mm-hmm. They're old. I'm getting close to 80 here. I'll be 80 in a couple of years, so maybe less than a couple of years.
Go into that much detail, do we?
No, we don't. We don't want to give any dates.
There was an incident where somebody left the front door of the clubhouse open.
Yeah, had a rule. If you left the front door open, you needed to be in control of what was going on out there. David Ortega, a real close brother of mine, I've known him since, he's passed now, but him and I met six. I was home on Marine Liberty, and I ran into him. He thought I was a cop because of my haircut. We always got in a fist fight. But anyways, he had left the front door unattended, and somebody threw a hand grenade in there. And I got the Ventura PD to give me the numbers off the spoon, and I traced the spoon back. Do you know this story? Yeah, I traced the spoon back to the ATF unit that had come out for the Olympics. I never accused the ATF of doing it in an official capacity, but I truly always felt that the ATF rogue agents threw that hand grenade in there. I don't think they threw it in there to hurt anybody. I think they threw it in there to get a search warrant to come in and look, because that's what they did. A couple of days later, they came in with a search warrant, and we had a couple of shotguns in there. And they went around looking for anybody that had a key to the clubhouse that was a felon. They were trying to put a constructive possession beef on them, and they took the watch list off the wall in the clubhouse, and they knew that two felons had been down there on a particular night when the shotguns were in there, and mm-hmm. they used that paperwork to get indictments against them. I mean, they didn't do much time. The judges felt it was a bullshit case. You know, we waived the jury and took a court trial and sentenced one guy to 6 months and one guy to 3 months. I mean, for felon in possession of a weapon, that's not much.
Yeah, it's set now. So I understand your position. My position was, that's thinking outside the box. They found a way to come in.
Yeah.
Not that hand grenade, but to get that search warrant. And then I would have never thought, you're in possession of a key. That means you have constructive possession of the weapons.
Yeah, the judge explained it to me. He said, look, Mr. Christie, if Mr. Ortega was in New York with that key in his pocket, and he got arrested. He's in possession. He's guilty of constructive possession. And I mean, it was a real eye-opener for me and a lot of other people. It made us think about things a lot different. I've known for years the sheriff who told me he thought the ATF did it. In this new book I'm writing, I identify the police officer. He's passed away. I told him I would never mention his name until he was gone. But I don't think we'll ever prove it. I doubt it. You know, no one's going to step forward. But
When I read it, that's one of the pages that got tabbed because I'm thinking, I don't know about that. 38 years as a cop, I know cops all around the world. I don't know anybody would do that. I'm not saying that it didn't happen. If it did, you know, those guys need to be under the jail.
Okay, well, let me elaborate a little bit more on it. Do you remember the Greensboro massacre where the ATF infiltrated the American Nazi Party? And it's the same squad. These guys were kind of hit below the belt. Can I prove it? No, I can't prove it. But my suspicion was that one of those guys threw the grenade in. But did he? I don't know. One of those things, you know what you know.
That's taking it to a whole different level.
Yeah, well.
That's not any law enforcement agency I ever joined.
Okay, well, I hope not.
And I got tons of friends in ATF. I worked a lot of cases with those guys. In fact, I used to work undercover with a guy in Miami back in the 80s, and he was from Tennessee. I grew up in Tennessee and West Virginia, so I had a real country accent, and he did too. And I was working undercover. We were providing transportation.
Boys.
Yeah. And our story was he had escaped prison in Tennessee for murder.
Okay.
So nobody would screw with me because they were afraid he'd kill them. But anyway, that's different stories. Okay, so towards the end there, why did you leave the Hells Angels? What happened to say, I've had enough, this isn't what I joined for?
Well, I think that we were fighting the outlaws. I had made sure everybody was willing to get along. And like a lot of these wars, we never had a conditional surrender, whatever you want to call it. It was just kind of amnesty on the violence, moratorium on the violence. Something was working against me. One of my guys got killed, a young guy named Josh. Sonny's right-hand man got killed. There was a lot of rumors in law enforcement that Sonny and I were going at it. That was in 2002, and my relationship with Sonny slowly unraveled from 2002 to my departure in 2011. And I just felt we had become the people we rebelled against. And I went to the meeting, and I said, we're fighting wars on five fronts, and now you guys want to fight the Vagos. I said, I've known the Vagos for 30 years. I go, they don't want to fight us. I just talked to them last week. And I go, what's the point? And I could just see nobody was listening. And I took my patch off, folded it up, and I put it on the table and got up and left.
And it was
About 2 weeks later, I got a phone call from the new leader in Ventura, and he said, we've changed your status to out bad. And I said, for what? What reasons? And I said, I didn't do anything. And they go, nah, we don't like the way you left. So I just said, so what am I to think? I said, I'm going to tell you something. I go, at least the goddamn cops give you a chance to go to court and stick up for yourself. I go, you guys had a trial and you didn't even call me? You didn't have the respect or balls? And then he told me, he said, well, we also want to come back over to your house. We want to look. We want to inspect your house, see if there's anything there that belongs to us. And I just told him, I said, well, if you come, you know it's going to be waiting for you. I go, I'm out bad, no contact. Same goes for you guys. Don't approach me. I won't approach you. And it just kind of spiraled from there. It got worse. They wanted me to cover my tattoos, and I wouldn't cover them. And I'm a pretty hard-headed old guy. And the purpose for covering tattoos was so people would know you aren't in the club anymore. And, you know, my departure from the Hells Angels was humbly. I mean, ultimately, I had that show on the History Channel, Outlaw Chronicles. I wrote the book. I mean, everybody knew I was out of the club, and I wasn't on good terms with the club. It's actually, that's where my newest book starts out, is the day before Sonny died, I got a phone call. They said to me, hey, man, if you want to straighten it out with Ralph, that's what we used to call him, and you better do it. He's not going to be around much longer. And in the morning, I got a phone call. He had passed during the night.
Are you still excommunicated?
Yes, I am. But what's interesting is I work as a defense expert. I'm a consultant and expert witness for the defense. And I've been petitioned lately. There's some Hell's Angels that want me to testify at a trial, which I think is kind of ironic. Yeah, it is what it is. I'm certainly not going to petition them to change it. It doesn't make sense. Recently, a lot of people from the Hell's Angels were following me on Instagram. And you know, like you said, I got a big following on there yesterday. You mentioned that. And they were just confronted me. They were reminding people not to follow me. I got a hold of the email that they put out, and they sent a reminder, George Christie's out bad. Do not follow him. Do not comment on anything he says. And so I wrote a counter one. I put, when you have to remind everyone what your position is, maybe it's time to reevaluate it. You know, yeah. But I'm not waiting for the phone to ring.
Well, as you know, I just looked this morning on Instagram. You only have 267,000 followers.
Yeah,
I'm not sure that email worked.
No, it didn't work. What's funny is I was in Spain when my marriage was unraveling. I got an option on one of my books. I have a book called Marks, and it's a fictional account of my life. And a production company over there bought it, the rights to it. And I went to Spain. I lived like a king over there for 3 years. And then COVID came. And the whole thing unraveled. While I was over there in Spain, a good friend of mine, a gal who I was friends with, as well as her husband, I was good friends. I've known her since I was 12. I met him when I was about 15, 16. But they were married for 57 years and passed away from cancer. So I wound up coming back to the United States after this COVID thing. And Beverly and I hooked up and we wound up getting married. So I'm doing a third time's a charm.
Congratulations.
Yeah, well, I'm feeling pretty good about it. Here's somebody I've known since I was 12. So my running story is she's been after me since I was 12. She's not buying it, though. I'm looking around the door now, make sure she's not listening.
So after everything you've been through in your life, you're idealistic in your own way at the beginning, want to be an outlaw, want to live life your way. You did 40 years of the Angels. You felt like, I mean, it sounds like they really left you out hanging there at the end. If you had it all to do over again, what would you change?
Well, I would, I don't know, probably nothing. It is what it is. I'm a stubborn guy. I'm idealistic. I saw things in my journey in the club. I always believed the club, I belong to the club. Sonny always felt the club belonged to him. And the things I'm saying, these aren't anything I didn't say to Sonny's face. You know, Sonny and I had a lot of problems. And I'll give you a short synopsis. In the mid-90s, there was a shooting at Steamboat Springs. I don't know if you remember reading about that in the book. One of my guys shot two Hell's Angels from another charter. They got all hopped up on crank and started imagining things was going on. They were playing real hard back and forth, as Hell's Angels do play hard. And he thought these guys were going to kill him. He got paranoid. The bathroom came out shooting. And you attack another Hell's Angel, we have an automatic kick out. And every Ventura member was at that run. And I called a special meeting about 2 o'clock in the morning. I went to the camp, got him. Police told me to get him out of there. We were afraid that members were going to kill him. Mm-hmm. I got him out of there. And in the morning, we voted him out. We had a special meeting, voted him out that night. I went back in the morning to tell everybody what had transpired, that we'd followed the club rules. He attacked another member. Now he was voted out. This is the first time I'd seen Sonny since he'd been back from prison. And he had been set up by Tony Tate, and it really tarnished his image a lot with the guys in the club. He had got set up by this informant. And so I come back into camp. I go, look, I go, little Eddie's out of the club. It's all been handled. And Sonny, there's a bunch of powerful members standing around this fire. I'm talking to everybody. And Sonny said, I wouldn't have kicked him out. I said, but Sonny, rules are rules. And right then and there, I kind of got the insight that if Sonny was willing to break a rule for somebody he didn't even know, he didn't even know who this guy was. The guy got in the club while Sonny was in prison. Then I figured he would be willing to break the rules for himself. And over the next several years, 15 years, that's what he did. And in 2011 came along, and I just couldn't take it anymore. I thought, I'm going to call this guy on his shit. And I did. He broke the rules time and again. Remember the movie producer and director Tony Scott?
Yeah, I remember the name.
He's Scott's brother. He was going to do a movie on him, and I got involved in that. He made a deal, got a lot of money for himself personally, zero amount for the club. Those are things I called him on, and I guess I got disillusioned. But when I came around the club, came around the question marks, I was a young kid, full of piss and vinegar, figured I was invincible, never die. You know, you probably went through the same shit as as a police officer. And over the years, you realize a lot of things aren't what they seem. You encounter a lot of disappointments, a lot of forks in the road. I mean, I would like to, if I could do it over, I'd like to go back with the knowledge I have now. I'd probably be king of the world.
Yeah, I got to say, there's one thing that's ironic about all this is, as an outlaw, you want to go by your own code, right, and your own rules. But when you joined the club, you had to go by their rules. It's kind of contradictive because...
It is.
And I remember you let your son, Georgie, in there when he wasn't 21 years.
Well, you know, it's and who his biggest supporter was?
Sonny.
Uncle Sonny.
Yeah.
And I was just like shaking my head. And the rule was you had to be 21 or have an ID that said you were 21. And Sonny broke it down in the meeting. He used the rules when
to
they
fit his situation.
Him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And Sonny, he's in the meeting and little George, he said, well, how old is he? You know, I mean, he knew how old he was. He wanted me to say it. Well, he's 18. Has he got an ID? Little Georgie. I got an ID. I'm 21. I think it was from Idaho or someplace. I don't even know whose name it was under, but he had an ID and it said he was 21. And Sonny said, hey, I was 17 when I got in the club. You know, what's the problem? And so Georgie was in. I have guilt feelings about it sometimes. I don't have the dreams like I did. I had the really profound dreams when I first left the club. The old guys in the dreams would come to me and go, you quit? You really quit? And then the young guys in the dreams would be asking me questions, and I'd be going, I'm not in the club, man. I can't direct you. I dream about my son. I dreamt about my son once. Him and I were riding out in the desert, and we saw an oasis way off in the distance. We rode to the oasis, and he put his hand on my shoulder. And he said, Dad, I'm tired. You go on. And so I rode out of the little oasis thing. I woke up. And to me, that was his message to me. Don't give up, Dad. You're still an outlaw.
Yeah.
This is when I was having all that tough time with the club. You know, he didn't like the way they were treating me. You know, a lot of the younger guys that I had brought into the club along with my son wound up leaving the club. You know, perhaps the way they were treating me. I don't. You hear these things and people mm-hmm. say these things, but. You know,
you don't know what's true and what's not.
No, you don't. And you and your partner put your ass out on the line. I don't mean any disrespect by this, but I'm sure after you got the job done and Pablo was dispatched, you probably had people say, well, I could have done it 5 years earlier. You know, you know how they are.
They take credit for things that they weren't even there for.
Well, you know, that was the amazing thing was down in L.A., the things people were taking credit for. That I was like, take credit all you want, man.
Yeah,
you're
yeah.
stupid. But a different thing being an outlaw and taking credit than being a law enforcement and taking credit. They probably would elevate their reputation and good standing and whatnot. But, you know, I'm happy for the decisions I made. I've written 3 books. I got a 4th book coming out. I got 2 books in the wings that one of them's about a vampire.
All right.
Yeah, it's a fiction book. He's an urban legend. They call him the Night Stalker, and he runs across a bike club named after it, the Night Stalker Bike Club. It's pretty interesting. I've had some people read it, and they liked it. It's not quite ready to be put out there yet. I wrote it when I was in Spain. Had a lot of long nights in Spain. I did nothing but work on the keyboard.
Yeah, and it's for our listeners, it was ironic because before we started recording part one of this, we were just chit-chatting here, catching up and talking about books. Turns out we have the same publisher, St. Martin's Press.
That's right, yeah.
So does that mean anything? I don't know. You know, that 6 degrees of separation is like
you know it means something somewhere.
Yeah.
Somebody's going to put something together that you were either passing information to me or I was passing information to you.
Whatever.
You can't
yep.
meet them, you know?
That's right. So listen, everybody, George, it's been an honor to have you on here. Thank you for being so transparent about your stories. I appreciate you letting me voice my opinions because we don't agree on everything, but story and I wasn't there.
Well, you know, maybe you should come on my podcast.
What? All you got to do is ask.
Okay, well, I'm going to put that together. I'm going to Texas next week. I'm doing a lecture out there, and then when I get back, you're going to hear from me.
I appreciate that. So all of our listeners here, one more time, this is Exile on Front Street. Let me make sure I got it up here where you can see
it.
Yeah,
you got it up there.
My Life is a Hell's Angel and Beyond by Sonny, I'm sorry, by George.
You just had to get under my skin, didn't you?
You know, when my partner and I are on stage, his name's Javier, sometimes I'll get to talking and I'll say, and then Pablo over there, oh gosh, I mean Javier. But
he probably don't appreciate that, huh?
He knows I'm an idiot, so he's good with it.
He's good with it. Okay.
Yeah, but he's also got other books out there, Outlaw Riding Through the Storm and Marked, M-A-R-K-E-D. You can find all of those on Amazon. If you want to follow George on Instagram, no matter what anybody says, it's your decision whether you follow him or not. Don't let other people tell you what to do.
That's
right.
You
can find him on Facebook as George Christie. Instagram is George Christie Jr. On X, you can find him at George FPC. On YouTube, check out his videos there. He's got a pretty good following over there under George Christie. And check out his website also, georgechristie.com. And Christie is C-H-R-I-S-T-I-E. I've got the website pulled up here right now, right next to Sonny Barger's screen here.
Sorry. You're just not going to let it go, are you?
You know, you said about being a smart ass.
Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah.
Listen, I really appreciate you having me on here. I hope I didn't shock any of your followers or fans. It is what it is. What can I say?
And that's the reason I bring guests on is for you to tell your story, not you tell me about your story. And I try to reiterate to everybody.
And I appreciate
that. Horse's mouth. Yep.
All right, my friend.
All right, George, thank you. Listeners, thank you guys so much for joining us again here on Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. Look forward to joining me next week. I got some more great guests coming on. I've got guests lined up months in advance now that I think are going to blow your doors off, and that's my whole intention this year. If you're not listening to this on YouTube, do me a favor, go over to YouTube, pull up Game of Crimes podcast, and hit that subscribe button. I'm trying to blow that channel up this year. I'm only over 1,000 subscribers, so I'm working to get up to 2,000, and then we're going to try to catch up to George here.
We're going to get you up there, man. We're going to get you on my podcast, and you'd be surprised, a lot of people, they want to hear what the other team had to say.
Absolutely, absolutely. So until next week, come on back to where you know what it is. It's the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all, the Game of Crimes. We'll see you guys next week.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Well, unfortunately, that's it for this week's episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. Thank you, folks, so much for taking the time to see and hear some of the best true crime content you can find anywhere. None of this would be possible without your support. If you didn't know this already, Game of Crimes is now on YouTube. Just type in Game of Crimes Podcast in the YouTube search bar. You can send me your comments on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or to our email address, which is gameofcrimespodcast@gmail.com. Our website, it's gameofcrimespodcast.com. That's where you'll find all our episodes, books written by our guests, merchandise, and more. If you're looking for even more content, now go over to patreon.com/gameofcrimes and sign up. There you'll find several bonus episodes each month, ranging from serious and current topics to some silly and fun events. And you can even get early access to each week's interviews before they drop on YouTube or wherever you listen to your podcast. You can even subscribe for free and hear the first 5 minutes of each episode, and that's to help you decide if you'd like to spend some of your hard-earned cash to hear more. That's patreon.com/gameofcrimes. To all our guests here on Game of Crimes, it's an honor and a pleasure to have you on the show. I mean that sincerely. Thank you for your service to your communities, your countries, and for taking the time to tell us about your adventurous lives. May God bless and protect all the men and women in law enforcement, our military, and all of our first responders. And you know what? This goes for all of our listeners as well. Thank you for your continued support. And just one last thought here. It's okay for us to have different ideas and different opinions, but it doesn't mean we can't continue to be friends. All right, my final thank you. Thanks for joining me again to play the biggest, the baddest, the most dangerous game of all, the Game of Crimes. I'll see y'all next week.
Love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.